It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, an astrophysicist takes us on a journey through the stars and the mind-blowing discoveries that are changing the way we see the universe.
First, Governor Walker sent a letter this week to the State Department of Transportation instructing the agency to submit their 2017 to 2019 budget proposal without any gas tax increases.
And the governor indicated that the budget would need to be submitted in full by September, which is a change from the normal November deadline.
Sean Johnson joins us now. He's Capital Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio. Sean, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, give us an outline of this message that the governor sent in a letter, a public letter, apparently, to the Department of Transportation. What was his message there?
His message, some of it was kind of a repetition of what he said repeatedly, but pretty firmly to his Department of Transportation secretary, and that was, I'm not going to support any kind of tax or fee increases. And also tucked in there was a message that I want you to minimize proposed spending on mega projects in Southeast Wisconsin should be minimized. So not only is the governor saying, I really mean it when I don't want new revenue, he's saying, here is what we are not going to build, essentially, in this public letter to the transportation secretary.
This has been an ongoing story for quite a while now. For the last budget, this was one of the biggest sticking points, how to fund roads. It sounds like the overall story, big picture, Sean, is we've got these plans. We've got these plans to build roads, maintain roads. We don't have enough money to pay for them as scheduled in the budget. And it's, we're not finding new revenue, so we're going to have to make cuts.
I think that's essentially going to be the first act of this multi-act play this time around. I mean, last time, if you look at the way that the budget proceeded, you're right, it was pretty contentious. It was one of those issues that really drug out the budget until almost when the governor was ready to announce for president. I mean, it was one of the last issues on the table last summer, and it proceeded much differently last time. Secretary Gottlieb proposed in that budget a $750 million increase in taxes and fees that was not well received by either the governor or the legislature, essentially, and they really butted heads and ultimately cut way back on the bonding that the governor proposed. This time around, the governor's saying, we're going to start out with these cuts, and essentially that leaves it to people who want to spend more or build more to, you know, go out and make their case.
Now, one maybe small point here, the governor says, hey, Department of Transportation, I want your complete budget when everybody else gives me their complete budgets in September. Usually, for some reason, transportation waits a couple months. What's the significance, if any?
So if there's going to be a public information, I mean, there's a little bit of speculation here, but if there's going to be some kind of a public push to increase spending or to rally a coalition to have more revenues for roads, it gives them a couple more months to kind of develop that push and that lobbying campaign to get lawmakers who stand to lose out on projects on board with maybe spending more. That's one possibility. I think it's also significant that does put it before the election. So that would be essentially what a lot of people are talking about in Assembly and Senate races throughout the state. Hard to say what impact that would have in those races, but that is a big way for the public to weigh in on this issue.
Now, this is the governor's starting bid, in a way, on transportation. That doesn't rule out the possibility that the legislature could come back and say, we're going to find new revenue, or we're going to allow new borrowing, or we're going to restore these construction projects. Would that set up a battle between the legislature and the governor, or would he maybe be okay with them doing the heavy lifting there?
It seems like that battle has already been, those battle lines have been drawn. You know, you've got the governor out there publicly for a while now saying he's still not going to support a gas tax or like a registration fee increase without a corresponding tax cut somewhere else. That's going to be really hard to do given the state of the general fund budget. And you've had Robin Voss, the Speaker of the Assembly, out there saying he fundamentally disagrees with the governor when it comes to transportation, because remember, the governor's last budget funded a lot of projects, the proposed budget, but it did it with $1.3 billion in proposed bonding. The legislature ended up scaling that way back, almost $500 million. And so I think next year, in many ways, is just a continuation of that fight that started next year is going to continue the fight that started last year.
Talking to WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about a long-running sticky issue in the Wisconsin budget, how we pay for transportation, road construction, road maintenance. Sean, you mentioned battle lines. Almost always when we talk about any issue in Wisconsin politics, it's Democrats over here and Republicans over there. It's different with transportation, it seems like.
Definitely different. Definitely different. And there's a possibility you could see a kind of coalition form between Republican and Democratic lawmakers if it came to that, because right now you do have, you know, a couple of the state's most prominent Republicans very much at odds on this issue of transportation funding before the session has even begun. You know, we don't even know who's going to be in the legislature next year, and they've already kind of dug in their heels. So it's different right away. You look at that. But then you also look at what some of, you know, what people like the chairman of the Legislature's Budget Committee and the speaker are saying about the need to pay for roads, very similar to what a lot of Democratic lawmakers are saying when it comes to the need to pay for roads. And they're all kind of singing the same tune when it comes to reducing borrowing to pay for roads. You know, I think you'd be hard-pressed to say what the final coalition of votes for or against a transportation budget would look like at this early stage.
Let me put out there a couple of strange bedfellow opportunities here. There could be regional politics, it seems like, if we're talking about cutting southeastern Wisconsin projects. You mentioned this to me earlier. You've got Republican suburban county lawmakers maybe working with Milwaukee Democratic lawmakers, parties that don't usually cooperate very well.
It seems like there's a potential for that. I mean, the governor made a point of putting a line in this this two-page letter about, you know, prioritizing the Southeast Wisconsin mega projects should be limited, should be minimized, was his word. Where does the bulk of our legislature come from these days in Wisconsin under this legislative map under Republican control? It's dominated in Southeast Wisconsin, which stands to lose out on some of these projects. So that's an attention getting line for those legislators. And it really kind of puts it all on the table for them. If they don't want to raise revenues, that's what's going to, you know, be cut.
And the governor mentioned, and you mentioned this a few moments ago, wanting to prioritize. And he said something like, we should build the roads we need, not necessarily the ones we want. We've heard similar things from environmental activist groups in the state. The Public Interest Research Group, Wisberg, was one that's been on the show, making a really similar case, I think.
Yeah, that's another one where you have very strange bedfellows between fiscal conservatives. Last year was Senate Republicans who didn't want to borrow anymore. And they were saying almost the exact same lines that you've heard from Wisberg or Thousand Friends of Wisconsin, groups that feel like we're building too many roads. These two groups agree on basically nothing, except when it comes to transportation funding, they seem to see eye to eye, maybe for different reasons, but they kind of both feel that we borrow too much and we spend too much on highways.
And how about local governments? The governor made a point of saying we want to prioritize local road building, and there's been talk that we've got kind of a backlog there. Do you think that's something that will bring people into the coalition to support what the governor is saying?
It's hard to say until you see what is ultimately out there. I think he called for an increase in funding that goes toward road safety. You could do that and not break the bank just because, that portion of the budget's going to be a lot smaller than, you know, these mega projects that cost hundreds of millions of dollars. So I think with that one, wait and see what's out there in terms of the actual dollar figure that they're talking about.
So this will be out a little earlier than usual, a couple months. Is that going to give more room for public input, maybe? Maybe the public weighs in during the elections? You mentioned this would be coming in before the election. And, of course, the lobbyist.
Yeah, I think the lobbyist is, you can't undersell that part of it. They're going to have more time to basically develop their strategy, to target their lawmakers, to try to form this coalition of votes to go against the governor, basically, if they want to do that. If what he comes out is not acceptable to them, this gives them a couple more months, which can mean a lot, you know, in the legislature, given that the budget process, once they come into session next year, the new legislature, budget process gets started pretty quickly.
There's a lot of variables here, of course. So we don't know who's going to be in the legislature, as you mentioned. We don't know what the final form of this. Can we predict that this is going to be one of the bigger budget, more complicated budget items we're going to see next year?
I think this, you know, people have been saying for a number of years that this transportation funding issue is really coming to a head. And at some point, man, we're going to have to deal with this. It's really getting bad out there. But really, it is really getting bad out there. I mean, we've gotten to a point where debt service is going to take 21 cents of every transportation dollar is going to go toward paying off old debt. So, you know, that's a lot of every dollar that we spend on transportation. More than a fifth of it's going toward debt. That's getting at people's attention because that's a trend that's it's not reversing. It's climbing. It's at its highest level ever. And so this may be the session when they actually do something about it.
Sean, we'll watch and see. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, Capital Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio. He joined us to talk about the latest on transportation funding here in the state. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, an up-close look at what makes us what we are, the human gene.
First, the universe is a weird place, and recent scientific discoveries and theories are making it look even weirder. From the bending of space-time to dark matter, black holes to the Big Bang, the universe acts in ways that seem counterintuitive to our human brains.
But as technology advances, some of the strangest ideas are being confirmed. One recent example, the measurement of gravitational waves, confirming one of Albert Einstein's predictions from a century ago.
In her new book, our next guest takes us on a tour through time and space and shares some of the most mind-blowing details about the universe. Priyamvada Natarajan joins us now. She's a professor of astronomy and physics at Yale University. Her new book is Mapping the Heavens, the radical scientific ideas that reveal the cosmos. Priyamvada, welcome to Central Time.
I'm delighted to be here.
Well, what first led you to want to explore the cosmos yourself?
Well, I was a young girl growing up in Delhi, and I got my first look at the heavens through a telescope, and that was it. I was hooked. And after that, I kind of pursued it by, you know, I had a Commodore 64. It was unusual at the time. Well, this dates me too, right? And I learned to program. And the first research project that I did under the guidance of the director of the Nehru Planetarium in Delhi was to make a sky chart for what would be visible about the night sky in Delhi. And, you know, she gave me that task and thought, you know, this pesky little kid, you know, she's not going to be able to do this. So when I came back 6 weeks later and said, well, I've done it, she said, well, Priya, what if you move to Boston? She was prescient, right? Somehow I went to college there later. Or Brisbane. Don't you think you would want to know what's up in the skies there? I said, oh, well, I've written the program in such a way that you can put in the latitude and longitude of any place on Earth. And it would just draw up the sky chart for you. So I really fell in love right then and there. And then, you know, I sort of meandered through physics and mathematics, and I got a scholarship to go to MIT. And so I sort of, you know, then did a bit of philosophy and then did a PhD in theoretical astrophysics. And here I am.
Well, you write that, you know, just a century ago, the going theory was that our galaxy was pretty much the only thing out there, the only galaxy. Catch us up. How did that start to change and what changed it?
Great. So, you know, at the beginning of the 1900s, it was believed that there was only one galaxy, and they were not even called galaxies. They were called nebulae. And it was actually Edwin Hubble, the astronomer, who really led a major revolution to transform our view. He realized that one other nebula that was nearby us, the Andromeda, was actually an independent galaxy. So he first established that there were other galaxies other than the Milky Way in the universe. Once he said that, did that, you know, he just set the stage for other remarkable discoveries, one of which he was really part of, which is he also discovered that the universe was expanding, that galaxies, neighboring galaxies around us were actually speeding away, hurtling away from us, and the speed at which they were hurtling away was proportional to their distance from us. So, you know, he kind of unfixed the universe. Till then, you know, the classical picture from Aristotle, Ptolemy, Plato was that we lived in a universe that was static and there was a fixed orb of stars. And although the sun and the moon set and they moved, and there were a few planets that moved, that there was a fixed set of stars that gave us stability. So Hubble really started the first sort of disorienting discovery for us. And of course, now we know that not only is the universe expanding, but the expansion is accelerating. So there's a gas pedal that's pushing us even faster and faster away from other galaxies. Of course, we don't quite know what is doing this, and we call this mysterious force because it's sort of a repulsive force that pushes things apart in contrast to gravity, which pulls everything in together. And we call this dark energy. You know, and this was discovered as recently as 1998. I was in graduate school when this was this discovery was made.
Yeah, what's it like to be in a field where new things, new findings are happening all the time, or old theories, old hypotheses are finally provable by new technology? How exciting is that?
It is. It's really absolutely wonderful. I feel so grateful to be born now because, I mean, I honestly, everyone says it's a golden age. I actually think it's a grand convergence, right? Because our theoretical ideas that have been around are now finally, we have the instrumentation and the technology as well as the computers to visualize, to test, and to either accept and validate theories, discard them, or find gaps in theories, right? So I think the most exciting thing now with all the sort of rapid pace of discoveries is whether there's anything, any new observation that appears to be discrepant with our current understanding. That would be really, really exciting because it will point the way forward to new theories, new ideas, and who knows, maybe another radical reconception of the universe.
Is there anything that looks likely along that same line right now? Anything that stands out as, you know, that doesn't really line up with the way we understand the universe?
Well, I mean, you know, by and large, the broad brush picture, we seem to kind of have it right. But there are lots of little details that don't work. And you never know because, you know, the God is in the gaps, as it were. And so, for example, we know that most of the matter in the universe, more than 90% of the matter content of the universe is made of dark matter. But we don't know what it's actually made of. The particle remains unknown, right? So, and we have a whole bunch of possible candidates that would, you know, behave in particular ways, would be spatially distributed in very specific ways. So we haven't really honed in. So I think, you know, we could be ready for some surprises. So I wouldn't be surprised if there is something that we did not imagine to be dark matter that turns out to be dark matter in terms of the particle. Or, for example, even with black holes, right? We've just discovered the gravitational waves from colliding black holes. And we are also poised to look at the shadow of the black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy with this new telescope called the Event Horizon Telescope. And the expectations are, you know, if Einstein's theory of general relativity is correct, the shadow would have a very particular shape given the mass of the black hole that we know independently. And if there is some deviation from that, it could point to some missing element in the theory.
We're talking to Priyamvada Natarajan. She's an astrophysicist. Her new book is called Mapping the Heavens. Priyamvada, you mentioned dark matter. I know that's a lot of your work is mapping dark matter. And I wonder, first of all, given that we can't really directly detect it, how do we know that this dark matter has to be out there?
Well, you know, the dark matter, its presence is indirectly inferred. So there are two main lines of evidence by which we figure out that there's copious amounts of dark matter in the universe. One of them is the effect, the gravitational effect. Because it's matter, it exerts gravity. So, for example, in individual galaxies contain a huge amount of dark matter. And so the stars, the motions of the stars that we can actually measure reflect the presence of this unseen matter. So they're moving around much faster than they would if the only gravity was provided by all the stars and the gas that we see. And the other really compelling and beautiful evidence comes from Einstein's theory of general relativity, where, you know, he kind of reconceptualized the cosmos for us, and he sort of introduced this entity called space-time, right? So which is this four-dimensional sheet, which is the universe. We are all on it. And any mass causes little potholes in this fabric. And light gets deflected, since light travels in the universe and it's our cosmic messenger. Light from very distant galaxies will follow the potholes that are generated by all the mass that lies in between this distant galaxy and us. And this is called gravitational lensing. And so this deflection produces a distortion in the shape of galaxies. So you don't see the actual original shape, but you see a very, very distorted shape for galaxies. And this effect has been observed. The Hubble Space Telescope has exquisite data that shows us these distorted shapes for galaxies. And from that, we're able to actually map dark matter, although we can't see it, from the extent of distortion, the strength of the distortions of background galaxies that the foreground distribution of lumps of dark matter generates. We're able to actually produce these exquisite spatial resolution maps of dark matter.
It sounds like we're getting to know, based on the movement of the objects around it, the shape of dark matter. But what are the remaining big questions about what dark matter is?
Well, it's the nature of of dark matter that remains unknown, right? So what is a particle? Like, when we know that it was probably not an ordinary atom, it's not ordinary atom, so it's something that's not on the periodic table. It's some exotic particle that formed likely very early in the universe and formed in huge amounts and has evolved over time with the universe as the universe has been expanding. The other thing that we do know is dark matter is in the driving seat of all structure formation in the assembly of galaxies. It sort of drives all of this in the cosmos. So, you know, it's a very critical ingredient of the universe, and we don't actually know what that particle is. So we are after that. There are experiments to directly detect it. And the idea is that you build a detector, you seal it from all other kind of confounding effects, place it, for example, in an underground mine, and you wait for these dark matter particles to go through. The problem with these dark matter particles are that they interact with very, very little else, not even themselves. So they actually routinely go right past us. So there's a huge number of dark matter particles that are probably sailing through us as I'm speaking to you. The question is, how do you capture them, because they don't actually interact with anything? But what is really exciting is that there have been experiments, and there's one particular experiment from about 12 years ago that claimed a detection of this particle, but nobody believed it because it was one experiment. And now finally, this experiment is going to be replicated in 5 locations on the Earth in the Southern Hemisphere. This experiment was called DAMA, and it was done in Italy in an underground mine. But now the same detector, which is a sodium iodide crystal, has been replicated. There's 5 copies of it, so 5 independent groups are going to go and look and to see whether that was actually a detection. So I'm kind of hopeful that in 3 years we'll know at least one thing about dark matter, whether it's already been detected or not, or if, you know, the quest is still on.
Well, we'll join you in watching for that in a few years. Priyamvada, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
That was astrophysicist Priyamvada Natarajan. Her new book is called Mapping the Heavens, the Radical Scientific Ideas That Reveal the Cosmos.
Coming up after the news, we'll turn from the furthest reaches of the universe to the hidden code of human genetics. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll learn about a proposed state law that would hold gun-free businesses liable for injuries.
First, genetics is a hot topic, not just in the world of science, but in high-tech business, agriculture, even in our personal lives. As genetic testing becomes more and more common, we're faced with health and ethical questions. Should we get tested for a genetic disease risk? Should our children? Should we modify the genes of the plants and animals we eat? Should we modify human genes?
As big a role as genetics play in the modern world, the gene itself was a recent discovery, with the discovery of DNA answering questions people have been asking for thousands of years and raising new questions, along with a flurry of scientific discovery.
Our next guest traces the past, present, and future of genetic science and is new book. Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee joins us now. He's assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University and a cancer physician and researcher. He got a lot of attention for his previous book, The Emperor of All Maladies, a biography of cancer. His new book is The Gene, An Intimate History. Dr. Mukherjee, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, after telling the story of cancer in The Emperor of All Maladies, what made you want to tackle the gene?
Well, you know, this book was, in some ways, it was conceived before I thought about the book on cancer. I'm a cancer physician. I treat cancer patients. I'm also a cancer geneticist. And this book was really prompted by the history of mental illness in my family. I have a family history of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. And over time, I began to realize that there's a strong genetic component. More than one generation, 2, perhaps 3 generations in my family have been affected. But not every person. So there's a kind of terror of knowing but not knowing. And it's a kind of terror that happens in many families, of knowing but not knowing, having a risk but not knowing whether you in particular will have that risk. And, you know, we talked about it as children, we talked about it as adolescents, but when I had my own children, and genetics was moving forward so rapidly, it's a question that was unavoidable, you know. How will we imagine these diseases in the future? What happens when we can, you know, we can predict them, not absolutely, you know, not with 100% probability, but with 10% probability? Will we change the way we think about ourselves? Will we start diagnosing ourselves before we have diseases? So all of this sort of begins the gene, and in some ways, again, it's a prequel to the Emperor of All Maladies.
Now, you're looking at the prehistory of the concept of the gene as well. It seems like people knew for a long time, thousands of years, that there's something that's being handed down from parents to children. They look similarly. Some things are similar between parents, children, grandparents. Why was this such a difficult scientific puzzle that we really weren't getting a solid answer until a little bit in the 1800s and into the last century as well?
Well, you know what's interesting is it's very counterintuitive, and I'll give you one example, you know. The example is that we now know that matter is composed of atoms, right? So you keep, you know, if you keep grinding matter, as it were, you get to a point of time where beyond enormous amounts of energy, you can't really grind matter any further. Molecules and atoms become the units of matter. That's a kind of counterintuitive idea. Most people would have thought that you keep, you know, keep grinding and you keep grinding, it keeps going away until it becomes basically vanishes. Genes are also, or were also, a counterintuitive idea. People thought that if you had a red animal and a blue animal, you'd sort of create a purple animal, you know, as a child. A child was a kind of wearing blender, and you'd just dilute and mix and match all the features of the adult, and you should make a child. But what Gregor Mendel discovered, and this is what's amazing, what's very counterintuitive, is that that's not how information across the biological world works. It works through pixels. They're pixels of information, and these pixels of information move from parents to children, and they get mixed up. We get various combinations, and that's why, you know, some of our features are different. These pixels of information intersect with chance, they intersect with the environment, they intersect with each other, and that's ultimately that creates you and me and ourselves. That's an incredible solution that was reached over, again, the last 150-odd years.
Well, let's tackle a really basic question with, I think, a really complicated answer. What is a gene?
A gene is a unit of information that is transmitted from cell to cell or from organism to organism. It specifies a feature, some feature, some activity, some function, such that that function is actualized in the organism or in the animal. It usually works by making a message called RNA. And often that RNA is made into a protein. But basically, a gene is a unit of information that specifies a particular function or feature in an organism. One gene can specify many functions. One function can be specified by many genes. But the truth remains is that the gene is a unit of information that is transmitted from one organism to the next.
Talking to Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee about his new book, The Gene, An Intimate History, looking at the past, present, and future of genetic science. Dr. Mukherjee, I think there was a stage early on in the world of genetics where, at least in the public eye, it was really simple. It was like Gregor Mendel's peas. There's a gene here that tells how round the pea is going to be, how long the pod is going to be, how green it'll be, that sort of thing, and then that translates out into what grows. The reality, for the most part, is way more complicated, isn't it?
The reality, as we now know, is more complicated. You know, Mendel was successful in doing what he was doing because he could isolate these features. But in humans, features that we think are, you know, simple, even simple features, the color of your eye, the kind of hair you have, how tall or short you are, is governed by not one gene but many genes and the interactions between genes and environments and chance. So what seems simple, on one hand, of course, it's very simply sort of information moving from parents to children can become very complicated. I often give a simple example, and that's why it's important to know this this story. The simple example is, imagine five colored sheets of transparent paper, you know, blue, white, green, yellow, purple. Now, if you overlap these sheets of paper in different combinations, you can get every spectrum of color, and it would seem that you can create any spectrum of color. But what's important is that at no point of time did you ever blend the sheets of transparent paper remain the same. It was their overlap that really created all these different spectra of color. That's what's happening to some extent in the genetic world. It's overlaps between various genes, gene variants, that are creating the variation in features, and there's a role of environment and there's a role of chance. Why is all of this important? It's important because if all of a sudden you could tamper with or you could change one of those transparent sheets of paper, you could change the color, you could change its size, you could eliminate it, say, then all of a sudden you can now begin to produce different spectra of what happens afterwards. And that's the kind of prospect that becomes very simultaneously very tantalizing and also very scary. And that's where we are now. We're now at a position where we can read the human genome, we can sort of predict very loosely some features, not all features, but some features about our future, and we can change parts of the human genome, at least in cells. The analogy that I like to give is that, you know, the human genome, genes, they have only four letters. There's only four letters in the alphabet. It's A, C, T, G. And if you were to look at the human genome, it would correspond to 66 full sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. So you'd walk into a giant room, a huge library, and every wall would be lined with an Encyclopedia Britannica. And if you took out one of these volumes, it would just read ACTG, GCC, CTG, CC, and so forth. Totally inscrutable to you and me. And yet, from that, an organism can build you, it can build me, it can build the commonalities that we have, and also the differences that we have. So that's the first thing that we need to contend with, that this information can be so rich that it can create these incredibly complex organisms out of that ACTG code. But number two is that now we can, in cells and potentially in embryos, but certainly in cells, we can change the code. We can go into that Encyclopedia Britannica, that 66 full sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica, look at one word and change the word from, one letter of that word to another letter of the word. ACTGCCC, we can change to AGTCCCC. And that technology is new. We can do it in human cells. We can do it in other animal cells. And that really changes the stakes of this whole equation, the stakes of this whole puzzle.
If we can find the part of that code that spells out, say, one specific change and alteration that raises a risk of, say, a particular type of cancer, is it possible that we can change that code, make it much less likely that a person would get that particular type of cancer?
Well, let's talk in specifics. I mean, you know, we now know that there are certain genes that are, that if you inherit those genes, your risk of cancer increases. So, could you in principle go and change that gene in a human embryo? In principle, you could. In practice, it would be virtually impossible now. But the pieces of technology that allow us to do this in principle have now been invented. In China, about a year ago, there was an experiment to change a gene that encodes for a blood disease in a human embryo. They were non-viable human embryos, so ultimately the experiment was naturally aborted. But of course, the proof of principle is already there. Could you change a gene in a particular human cell, in a living human? Perhaps you can. I'll give you one more example. Could you change it in an embryonic stem cell, derive sperm and eggs from those cells, and thereby introduce a genetic change in the human germline, the human genome line? Yes, again, in principle, you could. So all of a sudden, things that were fantastical ideas in terms of manipulating heredity are becoming real. They're becoming real in other animals or for other animals. We can do this in other animals. We can do it in insects. And potentially, if we could do that in other animals, we could do it in humans.
We're talking to Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee. He's telling the story of the gene and the latest in genetic science. His new book is The Gene, An Intimate History.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you done a genetic test, maybe to look for diseases or to trace your ancestry? Would you want to know if you were genetically predisposed to a disease or maybe if your child was? And what do you think of the idea of genetically modifying humans, and how do we begin to do it ethically? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a minute. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation about the science of genetics, from the prehistory of the concept of the gene to the frontiers of modern genetics. Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee is with us. His new book is called The Gene in Intimate History.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the science of genetics? Do you have high hopes for genetics as a way maybe to cure or prevent disease? Or do you worry about the ethics of genetic modification? Maybe a little of both. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Dr. Mukherjee, sticking with cancer for a moment, we were talking about the idea of modifying genes to reduce risk for cancer, but also does our growing understanding of genetics help us treat kinds of cancer that are out there, which are, in a way, genes gone wrong?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, this is what, you know, I do as an oncologist, as a cancer biologist. The way we understand cancer is at its very core a genetic disease. Genes are mutated from their normal form, and these mutations unleash the abnormal growth of cancer cells, and ultimately that's the central core of cancer. And we would not understand cancer, we would not be able to diagnose cancer properly or understand its biology properly without understanding genes. We use genes every day to try to understand cancer, and we use genes virtually every day to try to figure out ways to treat and cure cancer. Some of the most successful therapies in cancers are therapies where somehow or the other the genes that are mutated are being targeted using small molecules or other drugs. Those are some of the most successful therapies in cancer.
You also write about genes, genetics, and race. A lot of the modern science of genetics came at a time when people were dividing up the world by what they saw as different races. How does genetic variation cluster or not based on what we think of as racial and ethnic categories?
So it's a very important question. It's a very politically charged question, particularly today when the word race is being thrown around very loosely. It turns out that genes tell us a lot about race. Genes tell us that at least the classical categories of race, when these were invented in the 1850s, early 1800s, perhaps even earlier, that there is more variation in genetics within races than there are between races. The vast amount of genetic variation exists within races such that, you know, to say, for instance, the quote-unquote African man from Namibia is vastly different from an African man from Nigeria or from Somalia. Such that, you know, that kind of racial category doesn't make any sense, because if you're trying to reach or trying to use that to understand genes, you're going to have a very hard time because the variation is so great. Now, on the other hand, genes do tell us about ancestry. They can tell us where we come from. But what they cannot tell us is they actually do a very poor job of having multiple, as I said, categorizations, because there is so much of variation within humans that dominates that you don't have an easy time using, you know, what would be called enlightenment, although they were not enlightened at all. Enlightenment categories of races just don't make sense. It just doesn't make sense anymore, those words.
And you also write that there are some narrow uses. One particular group, one lineage, might be more prone to Tay-Sachs disease, another sickle cell anemia. So we've got a narrow concept like that. This can be medically useful. Broader concepts, you say, like, is a group more intelligent than another group? Is a group more attractive than another group? That genetics doesn't really have much to tell us there.
That's absolutely right. So if you narrow the categories, if you're asking a very narrow question, you know, is Tay-Sachs disease, or if you say, is cystic fibrosis more common among one geographic population than another geographic population? Well, of course you can answer that question, because ancestry predicts genes. Genes move along ancestral categories and geographies, because human populations move along ancestries and geographies. So if you have a very narrow question, you know, does one particular blood group, is it overrepresented in one geographic location? Is one particular disease, such as cystic fibrosis, more overrepresented? Then, of course, you can use genetics and geography to direct that question. On the other hand, if you ask questions like, you know, does one particular temperament predominate in one racial group versus another, that question becomes absurd because the category is so wide and the variability in humans is so great that you basically multiply uncertainty by uncertainty and you get a nonsensical answer. Now, what's important is that in this political climate, the former question seems to have been buried. The former question is really a medical question, right? You're trying to ask, what is the chance that the patient sitting in front of me, who happens to be from the western edge of Poland, is likely to have a mutated cystic fibrosis gene? That's a medical question. The political question is, how do we categorize races in terms of their behaviors, in terms of their essential features, et cetera, et cetera. That's becoming a progressively politicized question, and unfortunately, because of the nature of human variation, not a particularly important question that genetics can answer.
Talking to Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee, his new book is The Gene and Intimate History. Want to delve a little more into ethics, Dr. Mukherjee, of reading and maybe of modifying genes. First of all, a lot of tests are out there, testing for diseases, testing our ancestry, things like that. What are the frontiers of our rights to privacy? Who owns that information once they've taken that sample and run those tests?
Well, this is an incredibly important question because the right to privacy is very important because obviously you can imagine that, especially, you know, let's say one discovers that you have a future risk for breast cancer, say. I mean, can you be denied a particular form of insurance because, you know, your future risk for breast cancer is higher than anyone else in that particular subgroup that you're insuring? I think that the information should be extremely private. I think the information should be very well guarded. It should not be available in the public realm. And if it's available in the public realm, it should be made anonymous. That's the important part, to make it anonymous so that it can't be misused by people to understand, you know, where and how to use that information. A lot of people right now trying to find out their ancestry based on genetics, and it's fair enough. People are curious about where they came from, etc. But remember that information about your ancestry, if you sequence genomes, you will eventually start finding information about certain risk factors that you have for diseases. Right now, you know, the genome sequencing is pretty good with ancestry. It's not great at predicting future diseases, except for certain diseases. Again, I gave you some examples. The BRCA1 or the BRCA2 mutations will predict your risk of having a heightened risk of breast cancer. There are mutations that will have or will predict a heightened risk of having Alzheimer's disease in the future. Usually, these are not 100%. Usually, these are probabilistic. They tell you about risk. So, right now is a good time to think about it. But the information should be absolutely private and highly secure.
And then the ethics of genetic modification. And in just our last minute or two, if we could modify a gene to prevent cancer, I think probably a lot of people would be on board. But I want to bring things back to your relatives who dealt with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. Is that something we should consider, modifying our genes to prevent what we regard as mental illness?
Well, obviously a very tough question. Right now what we know about most of these mental illnesses, schizophrenia in particular, is that there isn't one single gene. So even if we wanted to modify it, we couldn't. But in fact, the bigger question is, should we even tamper with the human genome in this way? I believe the answer is no, because we don't have enough information and there are too many unintended consequences of trying to modify. It's not as if, with most of these genes, that, you know, if you have the gene, you'll get the disease. It is that you will have an increased risk, and that increase might be 10% higher than the normal population. You might require triggers. You might require environmental influences. So for most diseases, the genetics is complex, and I do not think that we're in a position to manipulate genomes, even if we had the technology, which we are having every day.
Dr. Mukherjee, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee. He's an assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University and a cancer physician and researcher. He's the author of the book, widely acclaimed, The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. We've been talking about his newest book. It's called The Gene, An Intimate History. You can head over to the Central Time Facebook page. We've got a link to a review of The Gene, An Intimate History there. And while you're there, we're curious to know, have you ever done genetic testing, a genetic screen? Obviously, protect your privacy there, but let us know if you have looked for a risk for a genetically linked disease. If you would want to know if you had that kind of risk, or if you've done it, maybe for fun and enlightenment, looking at your ancestry. Again, find that link and share your thoughts and your experiences in these frontiers of genetics at the Central Time Facebook page. A new movie franchise is born. The producer of a movie currently in the works says there's just too much material for only one movie. It's going to have to be a trilogy. The movie, Tetris.
You heard right. That's Tetris, the video game where you line up falling blocks. The movie was announced a couple of years ago, but this week's announcement of a trilogy has fans and critics trying to figure out exactly what a three-part Tetris movie would be about.
Yeah, I'm racking my brain on this one. The director or producer said, yeah, a lot of people are talking about, oh, there'd be anthropomorphic blocks running around. That's not it. So that rules that one out. So I don't know, how would you go about scripting a Tetris movie?
Something with the end of the world, falling blocks through the air, aliens, man.
I think there's got to be aliens dropping blocks somewhere. I'm thinking Tom Cruise. He was a hardworking bricklayer, and his job's about to get a lot harder.
Maybe.
There's got to be a bricklayer. That's all I've got. Well, I'm not excited to see how it comes out, honestly. But three movies worth, we'll see.
I think one of us said earlier, maybe find out if you can do one good movie about Tetris,
then,
the video game.
And then go for the trilogy.
But you know what? We may be eating crow on this one. This may be the definitive movie trilogy of all time.
We'll be stacking blocks here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.